for me, myself, like, you know, engineer to tech to product to now CEO, they're kind of like a progression of the same thing. As an engineer, the thing that I liked doing was, and I got off on, was building something, building my entire world. But that just happened to be some code that I had built, right? Some product that I had built. And then when I did it as a CTO, I did that with teams. And then when as the chief product officer, I did it with teams of technologists and product and design. And now as a CEO, I do that not only with those teams, but also with marketing and sales and, you know, business operations and all that kind of stuff. But I kind of fundamentally think it is the same thing as like I'm trying to create our own world.
Thanks for pressing play. This episode of Legends and Losers is sponsored by our good friends at Oracle NetSuite. To turbocharge your growth, check out netsuite.com/legends. On this episode, David Cancel, a.k.a. DC, a.k.a. the OG. This is a very, very cool guy. He is an entrepreneur. He is a CEO, a podcaster, and an author. He's currently co-founder and chief executive of Drift, a red-hot company in the marketing space. Prior to that, he was a co-founder of $5 billion publicly traded HubSpot. And he also is the host of one of my, or co-host of one of my favorite podcasts, Seeking Wisdom, and he wrote an awesome book called Hypergrowth. David and I have an awesome conversation about how to go from engineer to CEO, how to build massively valuable technology startups, how to legitimately, as a CEO, take a sabbatical, why books matter, and why DC says that conversational marketing is the future.
Hello, my legendary friends. This is Legends and Losers, the show for people who like to eavesdrop on killer dialogues, brilliant rants, and crazy diversions, straight up with a business twist. Hosted by Christopher Lockhead, former three-time CMO and co-author of Play Bigger, who has one of the most strategic minds in marketing, but could also hide his own Easter eggs. And now, strap yourselves in. It's time for Legends and Losers.
All right, all right, all right. The Ramon said, hey ho, let's go. And that's exactly what we're going to do. Hello, my legendary friends. Welcome to Legends and Losers, where we aspire to have authentic conversations, free range, real dialogues about what it takes to design a legendary life and a legendary business. And we hope that we capture conversations that matter, conversations that are fun, and conversations that you think are worth sharing. And I think that's what we have for you today. Now, quickly before we get to DC, I just want to say thank you for your shares. Thank you for your reviews. They make a huge difference to the show. They're driving our growth, and we appreciate it. As an independent podcaster, we're competing against some of the major companies on planet Earth, major media companies on planet Earth. And make no mistake, your reviews and your shares is what drives our growth. A recent review on Apple Podcasts I love, by a person who calls themselves Logo 17. The headline says, quote, "This is not your average self-help podcast. Super pump I came across this show. Christopher's show is the greatest up-and-coming self-help / business / marketing / comedy podcast out there today." I love it. So thank you. Now, today, David Cancel. I mentioned his podcast, Seeking Wisdom. If you want to get started and sort of get a sense of how unique his podcast is, check out episode number 121 of Seeking Wisdom, where they say they're going to review my book, Play Bigger. it's quite a magical mystery tour, and it'll give you an example of why Seeking Wisdom is such a unique unique podcast and why I enjoy it so much. DC has been on every media outlet you can possibly imagine because he's a big time thought leader in the entrepreneurship world. Stoked to have him, and here he is on Legends and Losers, David Cancel.
I'm doing awesome. I've come back from a 1 month sabbatical, so I'm refreshed. This is my first week back.
So how does a CEO of a hot startup pull off a 1 month sabbatical? Are you just a slacker or what's up?
with tons of anxiety and freaking out and panic. I came up with this idea a few years ago when we started the company and said, oh, instead of 5-year sabbaticals, we're going to have the idea of every 3-year sabbaticals because we go so hard, et cetera, et cetera. And so it finally came up this year. And my wife was like, you know, you're going to have to take it. And I was like, well, I'm not taking it. And she's like, no one in the company is going to take a sabbatical unless you take it. So I was like, holy shit. So I ended up planning to take it, had tons of anxiety doing it. And, but it turned out great. Some stuff broke, but that's okay. I know what, I know how to fix it now.
And how big's your company? How many employees do you have right now?
190 some odd.
Yeah. And look, I'm no expert on your business. You'll hopefully educate me, but it sort of feels like as an outside observer that, you know, this is a pretty critical point in your growth for the company, for the category. I'm sure for your products. Like it didn't feel like, oh yes, now's the perfect time.
No, it felt like the worst time possible. I mean, like, yeah, we're at this, we started this year, last year, we started 2017, we had 25 people, we ended around 90 people. So we started this year at 91, like 230, something like that, 230 people. So we're expanding and growing a lot and trying to define the category. And it was just like the worst time possible. But I had to show people that I would do it and that they could do it.
So you did it. And did you leave like an acting CEO in place or how did you?
Luckily I had a good management team and I have a co-founder. His name's Elias. So he's my CTO. I've worked with him for over a decade. And so he was here. So that was great. And then I had our CFO, who's fantastic and has done this many times before. So I had a lot of people to lean on and that's how we made it happen. Didn't think it was possible, but
wow,
it did be impossible.
I'm really impressed, man. Congratulations.
Thanks. So I'm back. I had one of the things, we call them kind of learning sabbaticals. So we like encourage people. Of course, I was the first to go off and try to learn and reflect and do all that stuff. And so I worked on three things. One of them was really having for the first time ever a daily meditation practice, which I did. I've tried it many times. And that gave me the, you know, a little bit of an ability to kind of step out and have, I don't want to say an out of body experience, but be able to see kind of myself. And I think the sabbatical did the same thing for me and the company to be able to see some of the stuff I wasn't seeing being in and being such a daily focused business. And I was able to see some of that stuff. So we're making some changes and I think we're setting ourselves up for a great 2019.
Wow. What things were you trying to learn on your learning sabbatical, Mr. DC? Or should I call you DC? It seems like DC. People call you
everyone
DC,
calls me DC. My wife calls me DC. So everyone. Three things. So power of threes. One was the meditation, which I mentioned. The other was an off-on kind of cyclist. So I wanted to actually spend some time getting better at mountain biking, road cycling. And so I did a lot of that stuff, gravel riding, did a ton of that every day. And then the third was my daughter's an equestrian, so she's into horseback riding. She's 13. And I was like, she just happened to have this competition in Vermont. And so I went with her for 2 weeks there, basically served as her horse hand, did whatever she wanted, drove her, you know, around, did everything, and basically did something that I have not been able to do before, which is just sit, be in the moment, and not worry about what's next, what's going on, why isn't this working? Just sat there and just did whatever she wanted me to do.
Wow. And how often were you on your email?
look, not at all because I was in a part of Vermont with like no cell coverage. So there was I couldn't even if I wanted to. I might've been if I wasn't. I had a Kindle with me though and I was reading.
I've grown to this place, maybe you have as well, where I now cherish the shit out of the places in my life I go where there's no internet or there's no cell coverage or, you know, like I like to go hiking.
Yep.
And I recently took two of my nephews out hiking in the Redwood Forest here and just outside of Santa Cruz and the Santa Cruz Mountains. And, you know, your cell phone doesn't work.
Nope.
And that's a feature, right?
Totally a feature. I feel that we have a house in Vermont and it has DSL internet that is, you know, like a modem, like a 28.8 modem. So it's like unusable for anything. There's no alternatives. Cell coverage doesn't work where we are. And so, and now I've looked at that as a feature, just like you described there. Like it drove me crazy at first. And now it's like, this is awesome.
Yeah. You know, I love, I'm sure as you do technology, it's a huge part of our lives and all that. And I think on balance, I do like, for example, Wi-Fi on planes more than I don't like it.
Oh, yeah, me too.
But there's a big asterisk on there, which is, for me, and I don't travel the way I used to, but when I was traveling all the time, on the plane was like really the only place in my regular life where you could get 6 to 12 hours of like, nobody is going to fucking bug me on this.
Yeah.
And that's now not totally the case, right?
No, you're totally on. Yeah. It's, and in some ways, and sometimes it's a feature for me because then I don't have guilt about traveling during the day, like going out to the Bay Area. But then sometimes the other half is just like you described. I just want to be alone, just be quiet. And by the way, I'm loving that Joey Ramone surfboard right there.
How cool is that, right?
It's amazing. I grew up in Queens, New York, and in the town right next to where the Ramones grew up. So,
did you see them?
Oh, yeah, definitely. They grew up in Richmond Hill, and I grew up in Forest Hills. It was just next door. And so we would see them all the time. It was just a different time, man, a different time.
Yeah. God, that must have been. One of my biggest regrets in life was I never got to see the Ramones live.
Oh, amazing. So I've seen them, you know, it was all the early days when I was there, you know, early certain era punk was going down a little bit, then hardcore was starting up, and so all the bands at CBGBs and all that. So did a lot of that stuff.
Wow. How very cool. Yeah, this surfboard, my buddy Vaughn O'Connor, who's a marketing guru in Australia, he's the founder of an outfit called Rapid Media, and they're killing it down there. WPP owns part of the company, and he's like the guru guy down there. And he's a wicked surfer. Actually, that's how I met him. I met him surfing in Fiji, and we were sort of became brothers in arms pretty quickly. And so this is a custom board he had made for me.
That's amazing.
This is a custom paint job of Joey. And Vaughn, being Vaughn, he's like, on one hand, like he's this tough fighter, charging surfer, like typical ass-kicking entrepreneur. But the flip side is, he's like maybe the sweetest man I've ever met. And so he comes over here for a business trip, DC, and he brings this fucking thing on the plane and shows up. I got this for you.
Yeah, that's amazing. And that's the best quote right there. Hey ho, let's go.
Right? It's sort of my theme of life.
Totally. It fits you. That's part of your, it seems like it's part of your soul right there.
It is. It's like that with great music, right? You swear to God that either A, the artist was writing it for you, or, I play a little guitar and I was in bands as a kid and stuff. And whenever I would do cover songs, and even to this day, I sort of have to feel like I wrote it to be able to play it, you know?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so, like the Ramones were the band that I wish I had been, right?
Oh, yeah. Everyone. They were amazing. So shame you didn't see them.
Yeah, I've seen pretty much all my other heroes that I wanted to see. I got to see Iggy Pop on his 60th birthday with the Stooges before they were all dead at the Warfield in San Francisco.
That's amazing. Did he have the moves still?
Oh, my God. He came out. It's literally his 60th birthday. Like, we sang to him. He comes out, and I think it might have been the first song, but it was definitely in the first three.
Yeah,
I Want to Be Your Dog, right? Which you'd expect to be the encore, right?
Yep.
He comes out. He's wearing the tightest fitting pants you've ever seen on a dude.
Yeah, yeah.
And the lowest cut. Like, if they were any lower, his gear would be out, right?
Yep.
of course, topless, 60 years old, looks incredible, and immediately starts stage diving.
That's insane. That's amazing.
Yeah.
What a picture.
Iggy. I mean, he's the godfather of punk for a reason, right?
Oh, totally. That's amazing. Oh, man. I love your setup in there. Is that your office?
Yeah, it's my office / studio. When we decided to do Legends and Losers, it worked out great because we built our home and we put the studio on top of the garage. My wife does a lot of art. She's incredibly creative and I play a little bit and stuff. And so we built the studio for my amps and guitars and for her art stuff. And we even put a little soundproofing in so I could turn the shit up if I wanted to. And so when we started Legends and Losers, this was the obvious place. And knowing that I was going to be spending a lot of time up here, my wife's insanely creative. And so she said, let's fucking build out a real studio that really is cool and is going to make you happy. And so, this is the happiest office I ever had.
It looks amazing. I'm jealous. I'm looking at everything. I recognize most things there.
Yeah, and I got, scotch, and I always had booze in my offices when I was a regular guy.
Wow, that was a different time, man. That time's gone.
You don't think you could have a little?
I don't know, man. I'm living in a different time now. Things are very correct right now.
Well, I would encourage you to be highly incorrect.
I have no choice. I'm still a New Yorker deep down, so I have to say what's on my mind.
Yeah, exactly. I always, it's been a little weird for me living on the West Coast for so long because mm-hmm. I don't have any of that passive aggressive.
Oh, yeah. You nailed it.
There's an expression out here. I'm sure you've probably heard the grin fuck, where they sort of smile at you and then fuck you later. And
I didn't know that term until I visited the West Coast. Yeah. That's patented over there.
Yeah. So I've never been good at the grin fuck. You know, I'll just tell you to your face, hey, DC, I think you're full of shit. You know?
Totally. I love it.
Actually, that's I was having Coast. A conversation this morning with an entrepreneur about this. And she was telling me that there was this guy she was interviewing as a potential CTO. And she spent a bunch of time with him, blah, blah, yada, yada. Anyway, this fucking guy decides to start a company that's competitive to hers, doing virtually the same thing, and is out now trying to raise money.
Yep.
And she was sort of asking me for advice, and I was telling her, you should tell people the truth, and you should pound this guy into the ground.
Yep.
And she's like, yeah, but, you know, I want to take the high road.
Mm.
And I said to her, the truth is the high road.
Ooh, I love that. It gave me chills there.
So I said to her, nailed when this it. Guy's name come up, you mm-hmm. say, let's just call him Jimmy. Jimmy's mm-hmm. a fucking asshole. Mm-hmm. Jimmy spent 3 months with me. We were trying to recruit him as CTO, and he ripped the idea off, and he's now getting it venture funded. That yep. makes him one of the giant assholes in Silicon Valley, and we are going to crush him, crush yep. his family, bury him, and bury the house that they live in. That's
I love
what
it.
Should say. And she said,
I need to roll with you.
Yeah, and she said to me, wow, like I feel better now. Like,
of yeah. course, the truth.
The truth is the high road, not this mamby-pamby, oh, well, you know, yes, I met him a while ago. No,
yeah.
fuck that. He's an asshole, and here's why, and we're going to kill him.
I love that. When's the book coming out there? I see a copy of it there. I've been waiting.
So this is my new book, Niche Down. It came out a couple weeks ago.
What? I didn't get my copy there. I signed.
I'm happy to send you one. And listen,
I'll get some.
Not to brag, but I'm going to. We were number one on day one we launched in both categories, small business and entrepreneurship.
That's amazing. That's fucking amazing. I need to get
amazing.
It. I love Play Bigger. I'm a disciple.
Yeah. You posted some really nice shit about Play Bigger. So thank you for that, DC.
I need to do it on this one too. I didn't know it was out. I was on the website. I signed up for the list, but I must have missed that it was out while I was on a sabbatical there.
Either that or you put me where I belong in your spam folder.
Yeah. And subscribe this guy.
Yeah, no, the new one's really fun because one of the huge questions I've gotten, pretty much the big question I've gotten, other than, you know, for drill down and specific things, but is how does category design apply to your career? Mm-hmm. Or if you're not, you know, DC doing a venture back, super ding dong, yeah. you know, trying to build a $1 billion+ company, but you're like a local pizza joint owner, what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
And so Niche Down is category design for your career and for small-y entrepreneurs. And the other big feedback we got on Play Bigger was, people love the stories, and so we like triple down on the stories in Niche Down.
I love it. It looks great, and it even matches perfectly your set, your office there. That's probably
yeah,
by,
how do you
by
like
design.
That? And hey, yeah. I got to show you these. These right here next to it. You see these babies?
What do you have, Niche Down socks?
No, these are Legends and
Losers. Oh, Legends
socks.
And Losers.
Same
I can
color.
Read it. Yeah, same color.
And we had on Legends and Losers, John and Mark Cronin, who are a father and son entrepreneur team, mm-hmm. who started this business called John's Crazy Socks.
And they did those?
And they did those for us. And John has actually got Down syndrome. He's a young,
oh, wow.
he's in his, you know, early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And when he graduated high school, Mark, his dad says, you know, so what do you want to do, son? And he says, I want to start a business with you, Dad.
That's awesome.
And so they're, I don't know, about a year and a half in. They're absolutely killing it. They're growing like crazy. They got former presidents loving them. And so I fell in love with them when they came on the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent them an email afterwards. And I said, you know, what's the minimum order? And they said 120 pairs. And I said, all right, let's do some Legends and Losers, John's Crazy Socks.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I love them. And they almost match the epic album cover right there, London Calling.
Yeah, right. We got the pink and the London Calling. See,
yeah,
I've always loved the pink because, you know, pink was always punk, right?
The oh, punk totally punk.
Always
yeah.
took the black and pink.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I've always been black and pink because of that. It's my my punk roots.
Totally makes sense. Play bigger black, niche down pink.
Yeah, yeah, fun, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you've just gotten back.
Yep.
And how's the business going?
Business is going amazing. And we're growing at, I mean, this is like, I don't know what the right comparison is, but like we're growing faster than any company I've ever been a part of. And we benchmark ourselves obsessively against other companies in our category and outside of our category and all that stuff. And we're growing way faster than those companies. And that continues to be the truth. So
it continues to be. You've been a part of some giant successes.
Oh, yeah. Some big ones, but this is growing 2 to 3 times the speed of those companies, which is amazing.
I'm not misforgetting. Weren't you a big ding dong at HubSpot from the beginning?
Yeah. Yeah. So I was chief product officer at HubSpot.
Yeah, that's what I left
when we went public, and as a company started Drift right after that. And then we grew like a rocket ship there. And, but we're lucky enough to be growing even faster at Drift, which
wow.
I didn't think was imaginable.
Wow, as my French brethren would say, félicitations.
Yeah, lucky. So we're trying to keep that going. We're trying to figure out how to scale, how to not break, how to not implode. I think that's the biggest one that I'm thinking about is like, how do we not implode? How do we not fuck it up?
Have you read my buddy Jeff Hoffman's book, Scale?
No, I have not. It's called Scale.
The book's just called Scale.
No.
And Jeff was he's an unbelievable entrepreneur. He's done lots of things, but the thing he's probably most famous for is being the CEO of Priceline.com.
Oh, I need to read that. Yeah.
Yeah. No, he's in the parlance of our times, a legit billionaire, a multi-time crazy successful guy. And the other thing I love about Jeff, his whole mission in life is entrepreneurship. He travels all around the world. He goes to third world countries. He leads these, you know, workshops and training sessions. And like, he's just all about giving back and all about sparking entrepreneurship. But his book Scale, there's a lot of entrepreneurs I know who put it in their top five, you know, it's a great book.
I'm an obsessive reader. So that's on, I'm ordering that right after this.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause we need to have Drift be a giant multi-billion dollar publicly traded category king, don't we?
Exactly. Exactly. We want to be category king so we can be in your third book. Whatever that is. Yeah.
Actually, it's funny you say that. I never thought after the first one there'd be a second one. And Heather Clancy has been posting online, and every once in a while she posts, you know, something to the effect of my first book with Christopher Lockhead. And I'm not sure if she means my first book or my first book with Christopher Lockhead, but every time she posts it, I say to her, does that mean there's a second?
Yep.
She hasn't committed yet, though.
How long of a process was it to write your second versus the first one?
You know, the second was a lot quicker.
Okay.
We decided in January and the book came out in July.
That's amazing. That's fast.
Yeah. Well, first of all, from a content perspective, it's about half the size. So it's, I forget how many words, but it's about 125-ish pages.
Yep.
And Play Bigger is 270-ish pages.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, by comparison, it's a mini book.
Yep.
But the aha we had, DC, is that, you know, because I thought, well, fuck, if we don't make it 300 pages, like, is it a real book? And we talked to a lot of people, and they said, no, you know what? We love small books. Like, write a short book.
Same.
So, you know, we didn't know how long it was going to be. We felt it was going to be shorter for sure because we wanted to take a very narrow slice at what we wanted to look at. So that was the first piece. The second piece is, you know, HarperCollins, God bless them, produced the first one. Heather and I decided to self-publish this one primarily because we wanted it in market quickly. You know, there's great advantages to, you know, when your publisher is the same publisher as Jack Welch and shit. You know, it's a very big prestigious thing and all that. And I'm stoked that we did that on the first one. But we wanted this one out. The weirdest part of going with a traditional publishing paradigm is, you know, we hand in the manuscript to Play Bigger at Thanksgiving, and the book comes out in June.
Yeah, it's crazy. That's why when you said January to June, I was like, how the hell did he publish this? Because we're working on a book now here called Conversational Marketing, and which is the category, and we're working with a publisher, and it's a long, as you know, it's a long process.
Yeah, if your book comes out 6 months after you deliver to him, then you're doing well. And I don't know how you will feel. I'll tell you how I am not a person who's known for patience.
Same. Yeah.
And so what that period from Thanksgiving to, it was June, it was either 14th or 16th we came out. Mm-hmm. Anyway, whatever it was, it every fucking night was like the night before Christmas, and I was like six.
Yeah.
Only it wasn't Christmas the next morning. You know what
You're
I mean?
Like, ah, yeah.
Fuck, where's the fucking book?
Yeah.
The, what do you mean it's only January? What the yeah. fuck? Where's the book? Yeah, it's
painful.
Hard. Very painful.
Painful. We're wrapping it up now, and so feeling the pain already, thinking about how long it's going to take there.
Yeah. The other thing, and I'm sure you know this, you're no dummy, but I'll state the obvious. Writing the book is 10% of the work.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then yeah. publicizing that bad boy.
Well, there. I don't know the exact number. I believe there's over 10,000 business books a year that come out.
What?
Business books, yeah.
Yeah, I had no idea. I had done no research.
And a nonfiction book, I just read this, actually, because Heather and I were talking about this as Niche Down was coming out. If I'm remembering the articles I found, I think a lot of people say that a nonfiction book, if it sells about 3,000 copies, it's doing well. That's the number that I remember reading in a number of different kind of industry rags. And so, and here's the truth. Selling 3,000 books is a non-trivial thing to go do.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, I'm happy to report that, Play Bigger did way, way better than that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And Niche Down came out screaming and is continuing to build. So, it's great to know that, we smoke some numbers. But it's also, it's a daunting thing when you think there's at least 10,000 business books a year. And if you sell 3,000, you're like a rock star.
It's amazing. I meant to send you a picture. You know where I saw a stack of Play Bigger books? At one of our investors' office, Sequoia.
Yeah. I would love that picture.
I'll send it. It's right. It's in the lobby. I'll send that over to you.
And you know what? Those folks have been so, way beyond good to me. Like, when the book came out, Getz bought a giant big order. Like, he essentially wanted to make sure we were a bestseller right out of the chute. So he bam.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then, listen, if you had said to me, the 18-year-old failure that I am, that, I would write a book as a dyslexic fuck. And that one day, the top venture firm in Silicon Valley would have it in the lobby to give away to people.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah. And so I owe them a giant thank you and grit of datitude. Yeah, that.
Yeah. No, it's awesome to see. And we have copies. I'll send you another photo of copies of it that we have here in our office. Because we have I'm obsessed with reading and learning. And that's a big thing at Drift. And we have stacks of books that we give away to people who come interview, to customers. We have a customer lounge. We have all that set up. And to, obviously, everyone on the team. And Play Bigger is one of those books.
Well, awesome. I'll need to get your address. And I'll happily send you a signed copy of both books.
Oh, thank you.
And some crazy socks.
Thank you.
I would encourage you. It's been a few weeks now since we got the crazy socks.
Yeah.
And they are the best corporate giveaway, if I could call them that I've ever had. Because, first of all, they look really fun. And, the folks at John's Crazy Socks will help you come up with an awesome Drift sock.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you hand them to somebody and you explain to them who John and the company is.
Oh, yeah. Great
story.
They
never forget that shit, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So
I need to do it. We're overdue for socks.
I asked them if I could call them the official sock supplier to Legends of Losers. And so I have their approval to do that. And so I'm trying to be a sock salesman for John and Mark and the team.
Well, we'll be getting some. So count us as one.
So tell me about conversational marketing. You are trying to do, what I've dedicated my life to trying to
figure out. Create a new category. So
tell me all about it.
Yeah, so we came up with this name, this category name, probably a little over 12 to 18 months ago, maybe 2 years now. And basically what we had done was, I've been in the marketing and sales software world for a long time. And when I was starting Drift, I basically started the company just observing what I was seeing happening in the world. And that was that all of a sudden, if I look at my daughter, she's 13, her idea of a brand, her idea of being able to communicate and kind of have a relationship with a brand is a radically different thing than all of us, right? All of, you know, some of us who grew up in our time, I don't know how you are. You know, I remember people working with people who would carry, who would have strict separation between work and personal, you know, would carry a work phone and a personal phone. I wasn't one of those people, but I knew some. That's what I'm going to say. And then I look at new generations, whether it's my daughter or people who are coming online across the world, and they don't really think that way anymore. And the way that they buy is totally different than the way that we all bought. And the way the expectations of the customer experience are radically different. And at the same time, so I saw that happening. I saw kind of messaging becoming kind of the default way that we communicate for all of us, right? And that happened almost overnight, right? I went from a world of, I've used every form of messaging from IRC to AOL to ICQ to whatever for 25 years, but really was in the last 5 years that I defaulted to almost always wanting to use messaging, not picking up my phone, rarely getting back on emails. And I saw the rest of the world doing this and I said, holy shit, you know, like that's changing the way that we're communicating. And then I saw like the other thing happening, which was like, you know, like an infinite supply of competitors in any category that you're in. So we as consumers have infinite choice. And, you know, thought about that and said, okay, the way that we sell and market, especially in B2B, which is where we are, has to change, right? We no longer have control if all of us have infinite supply. And so like, how is marketing and sale going to change? And so we came up with this idea of like, let's go back to the way that we always used to sell, which was, you know, no sale starts without a conversation, right? Instead of putting up hurdles and gates and forms and this and that and all the qualifications, why don't we just talk to the people who walk into our store, AKA our website? Why don't we have that conversation? Why don't we try to help them? And if we do that, we think we can have better performance from a sales and marketing standpoint. So that was the beginning. Yep. And then we kind of called that kind of conversational marketing, basically being able to scale that one-to-one kind of conversation. And that's the way that we all communicate today.
That's awesome. It's so smart. You know, my buddy, Kevin Maney, who co-authored Play Bigger as well. Mm-hmm. He's got another new book out that is a fucking killer called Unscaled.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. I love the title already.
Yeah. Well, and his notion with his co-author is Hemant Taneja, one of the General Catalyst guys.
Yeah. I've known him for years.
And their concept was, you know, in the past when physical mattered, if I could call it that. Mm-hmm. You needed to be big, right? You GE and all this shit, right? Mm-hmm. And giant footprint and Walmart and all of it that we all understand. And today their argument is that's actually a liability.
Yes.
As we've moved to bits. Mm-hmm. And you want to be a small, nimble company, and you want to be, even on an individual basis, the term that they use is a personal enterprise.
Yep.
And, you know, like I look at it in my own little world. I didn't know when I was starting Play Bigger, the book, or starting Legends and Losers, the podcast, that, you know, I was starting a media company.
Totally. But
we have a little fucking media company.
Uh-huh. 100%.
And, you know, we only have two employees, but we have literally, I mean, if I had to add them up, I bet you there's 40 people involved on a semi-regular basis in one way or another. Mm-hmm. With this little media company, but we're, to use Kevin's terms, we're totally unscaled. It's sort of like the way movies get made. We come together, small group, do the thing,
and disband
apart, but right. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very powerful idea. And so if I play that out, one of the things he says in this unscaled world is it does allow for all these micro niches.
Yep.
And we want to use technology that allow us to, from an experience point of view, go back in time to humanize business using the technology, as opposed to what we've done, which is, hey, a website is a really awesome fucking way to never have to deal with anybody.
Exactly. Let's never talk to them. And then let's sit all day inside of these companies saying, why don't we have anyone to talk to? Why don't we have any customers? What's going on? It's kind of lunacy. It's actually, you know, I've been in this industry for so long that I kind of looked when we were starting, I think we've reached peak insanity, because it's like, we get all these people. If you think about your website, like a store, and you'd say like, well, I have the store, and then I spend all my time trying to get people to the store. But when you come in the store, there's no one in the fucking store. And when you come in and you're like, hey, I want to talk to someone, well, we won't talk to you. And then we say, yo, fill out this piece of paper with your name and email address. And maybe one day, if you're qualified, we will contact you and tell you to come back in the store because now we're ready to talk to you. Like if you were to describe that to a normal person, you'd be like, what are you talking about? And they're like, that's state of the art. That is the state of the art B2B sales and marketing process today. Well, for all companies.
Funny thing, to just echo your point, when we started Legends and Losers, yeah. DC, you know, we had to have a general mailbox, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And my wife, Carrie, so we're trying to figure out, you know, is it info at Legends and Losers?
Yeah,
it can't be something like, it's got to be something good, fun, right?
Yeah.
So she goes, I know what you should do. Make the email address blackhole@legendsandlosers.com. Because when you email most companies, or
it just goes in a black hole.
It just goes in a black hole. And you're like, hey, I have a question about your product, trying to buy it, eh?
Yeah.
Black fucking hole, no response, right? So our email address is blackhole.
Blackhole. That's awesome. You're never going to get a response, but at least you're up front about it.
Well, we bust our hump to get the responses.
You know,
it's getting harder over time, but, you know, if somebody addresses it directly to me, then it gets forwarded to me and I try to respond and we all, you know, candy and whatever. But anyway, let's get back to conversational. So how is conversational marketing different, or how should I think about it in the context of, say, chatbots and what's happened there?
Yep. So we use chatbots and all that kind of stuff at Drift, right? We're probably one of the most popular chatbots out there. But basically, like, it's about what is the point? The point for us in conversational marketing is to start the conversation, right? To start the conversation to help the customer. And in order, we figured out, like, wait, in order to do that, in order to scale, in order to be able to do that 24/7, 365 when we're asleep, we need something to do that. And so we brought in this idea of what we call the lead bot, which is a bot. And that bot has a conversation with the person, but we had a few tenants, and one of them was the bot will always be a bot. So it's not Alice, it's not Lisa, it's not John, it's not some fake human, it's a bot. And it says it's a bot. And as soon as you do that, people understand what they're dealing with, right? And they know, and the expectations are set properly instead of thinking like, is this a human? Is this a bot? And so we had that as a rule. And so we did that. And so we were able to qualify people and answer their questions 24/7, 365. And then when there's a match, we can make a decision and say, hey, is Chris around? And should we try to connect them? Oh, he is around. Let me ping him on his phone and say, there's someone here and I think we should talk to him. Or maybe he's not around, and then we say Chris is not around, but here's his calendar. Why don't you choose the time that you want him to call you back? So give you the power, right, as the customer of when you want this person to get back to you. So it kind of turns the whole thing around. Instead of it being about faking people and replacing people, it's about, like, how do we help that person? Because that person at the end of the day actually doesn't care if it's a bot or this or that or a search engine. They just want an answer to their question, right? Like, I think, like, the way that things are going is, I just want to be helped. I don't care how you do it. That's, like, your problem, how you do it. Like, I always say, like, if I go search on Google for something, like, do I care that that's an algorithm, that that's AI, that that's a bot, that that's, 4,000 people in Asia who hand answer those things? I don't care, right? That's an internal kind of Google problem. And by the way, it's all of those things. But that's not a thing that I care about and I shouldn't have to care about. And that's where we think the same thing when it comes to conversations.
I love that you're being declarative because, authenticity matters. It's a hot word. Everybody talks about it. But the truth is most people and most companies are deeply inauthentic.
Yep.
And to your point, what none of us want is to be dealing with a bot and being trying to fool me into thinking it's a fucking person.
Yep. It's the worst experience possible. And you just set yourself up for failure because it's never going to work. It's never going to be work just right. And as soon as you do that, you lose the trust. And for us, that was something that was fundamental, right? We wouldn't do this unless we were always clear what it was.
And the fuck job on when we did this with phones, right? You know, so I grew up in the CRM business, Vantiv and all that work. You know, so I understand that whole world. The big fucking fuck up on the technology, I think, was the vast majority of companies, even to this day, there's no clear way to get to a person.
Yep. There's no way out. Yep.
And so you're on the phone, whether it's tech support or on the buying side, whatever it is, and you're saying, person, agent,
yeah, everything. Being.
Hey,
yeah.
Fuck, somebody real, right?
Yeah.
And so
never, it's a dead end.
It never fucking happens.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look on most companies' websites today, it's really, really fucking hard to find a phone number to call.
Impossible, yeah.
And so how do we make sure we don't recommit the sins of the past, DC? In other words, mm-hmm. I might be very fine dealing with a bot. Maybe about it. Maybe I have some product questions I'm thinking about buying.
Yeah.
Or maybe I have some base support questions that are sort of a bot can handle. But as you well know, if it's a more complicated thing,
sure.
Or there's some of us like myself, because I call it dysfucklia, right? Forms and FAQs and all this stuff. It's going to be very hard for me. I need to talk to a human being.
Yeah.
Not all the time. If it's a mm-hmm. basic thing, even someone with my, you know, limited capability might be able to get there. But I come to a place, as I'm sure most people do, where they go, okay, I've tried this. I looked at your FAQ. I did mm-hmm. whatever it is. I want a human being.
Yep.
And so how do we use this conversational marketing technology? So sort of right application for right scenario, and we don't have that scenario where it's really just a deflector and I can never get to a human being,
yeah.
and therefore I piss off my customers.
It's an important question. So what we did and how we designed it was to design it around kind of human incentives. So how are we going to incent the people on the other side to care about this? And what we did was money, right? We incent them by revenue. And so the way that we work with all of our customers is they use Drift to increase their revenue. So it's framed around revenue. And so when someone is, for us, the sales reps who would man a lot of this in various companies are dying to have a conversation because they know it's the fastest path to revenue, right? If someone is qualified for them by the bot, and so we're doing all the work for them, and they're only getting contacted when it's a good when it's the right opportunity, they love it. Or on the side, if you're an existing customer with an account manager, or a CSM or support person or whatever, we know who you are. When we contact them, we're like, this is how much it's worth to your business. We report that back to the business, back to their managers, back to everyone in the org, and basically try to make it easier for those agents and those reps, and always frame it in terms of how much revenue potential, how much revenue are you leaving? And so we're using basic human kind of incentives, like what are they incented by? They're incented by making money. The company wants to make money. And so we frame everything that way instead of framing it as just a nuisance, as some support, as some noise, as some stuff to get rid of. We frame it in terms of how much revenue opportunity there is that they're losing for each single one of those conversations.
Got it. And you enable me as a company to design my conversational marketing.
Totally.
Do you call them bots? Is that what you call them?
Yeah, your bots and your flows and, you know, who should it go to? And, you know, all the, some companies are super complex. So should this go to all your routing rules? Should it go to this rep or that rep or this region or what have you? All of that kind of stuff. We allow you to design in and we help you design that logic.
And you guys have some sort of a workflow designer that allows mm-hmm. me to do that. Just, you know, I'm trying to think about how much should I think about HubSpot as a corollary for the sort of, I don't want to.
You know, the stuff that we built at HubSpot was, and as chief product officer was more around, is around inbound. It's around content creation. So hosting your website, it's around sending email, so marketing automation and the workflow rules around that.
Yep.
And it's around social media and some of the other content stuff. So basically think of the top of the funnel. Drift is more focused on that, taking someone through the entire buying funnel, almost skipping the funnel, right? And going outside of that. And so it's a very different process. It's more around a more natural conversation versus setting you up for stages of qualifications and hurdles that you're jumping. And so we work alongside those kind of tools, whether it's that one or Salesforce or any of those kind of tools. But we're really, we think about ourselves as like the easy pass or the fast pass on the highway, right? Like that can go around all that stuff and not get you stuck in some nurturing flow or some chain of emails or 10, 15 forms or FAQs.
The other one I love about that, the sort of, and this is sort of right, you got to use the technology in the right way. One mm-hmm. of the misuses of HubSpot I see all the time is, you know, people have this nurturing maturation
yes.
model and all that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey, I don't need you to nurture me for a month. I'm trying to buy your fucking shit.
Totally, totally. And that's what we did. The whole industry did, right? We overreacted. We took a tool with marketing automation and all that stuff. And I was part of that industry. And we kind of used it for everything and forced everyone to go through that process and be like, never let them actually talk to someone. That's what we're trying to solve with Drift and conversational marketing. So like, I don't want to fill out your form. I don't want to go in your nurturing flow. I don't want to get 20 emails. I don't want to wait until I have a lead score of 86. Like, I just need to talk to someone. I already know what I need to buy, right? And that's becoming more true every day. Like, if I'm coming to you, I know what I need. Especially if I'm B2B, I'm not browsing your site because I have nothing to do. And so I have a question that I need an answer to, and I need the fastest path to that answer.
It's so funny you say that, you know, because some companies, it's almost like you have to know the secret handshake to buy from them.
Yeah, it's absolutely. Like, hey,
I'm not an expert in this thing. I'm trying to do whatever it is. You know, for me in the podcast world, right? Mm-hmm. This equipment and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Now, luckily, I have smart technical people who generally tell me what to go do. But every once in a while, like you and I had today,
yeah,
something happens. And I need to, and like they talk to you. Or you mentioned biking.
Yes.
I used to live in Tahoe.
And there's
a couple of bike shops on the north side of Tahoe. And one of them, which I won't name, but I'm sure they're nice people. But I fucking walk in there and they look at me and they just decide I'm not in the club.
Yep. And they just ignore.
I don't look like a cyclist. Yeah. I'm 6 feet tall. I'm 190 pounds. I don't look like a bike rider at all. And I don't know about all the carbodingulation and deconfibrillation. And I just like to go on my mountain bike, get a workout, enjoy the you know, the woods, get my groove on, and get the fuck out of there. I'm never going to be this technical gene. But all these little skinny 155 fucks who like go five times faster than me and know all this stuff. And they just sort of look at me and like I ask a question and they're like insulted that I'm there. You know what I'm saying?
Yep, absolutely. That happens to all of us all the time, right? We hate that experience. And then we have the opposite of that. We all have examples of amazing experience. And for us, like, that's really what fuels our passion around conversational marketing. And what we're doing is like, we want to have those amazing experiences all the time, right? And because, not only because we like it, but because we think that's where the world is going. If you go into more and more infinite choice in every category, then the money is going to flow to those people that provide you some experience that you love. Right. Yep. And that's what we pay disproportionately. We pay more money, all of us, for experiences that we love. And anything that's just a basic commodity, I can get that anywhere. I'm gonna pay nothing for that.
Yep. And you mentioned a term, a word earlier that is rattling around in my head, DC. You said a more natural experience. Mm-hmm. Could you unpack that one a little bit, what you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, I look at all the stuff we've done in the industry for my time, you know, like 25 years. And I felt like, you know, we had this arms race around being digital marketers, measuring everything, you know, all of these kind of hurdles. And we forgot the basics of relationships, the basics of selling, the basics of, you know, what does a natural experience feel like when you want to do business with someone or you have a question about something or someone or something or a product? Like, what does that actually feel like in the real world, right? And forget about all the stuff that we're doing digitally. Like, what is the best experience feel like? And then now, how do we take that and emulate that in the things that we do, whether it's digital or not, right? And so we lost all of that kind of racing towards this idea of measure everything and data-driven everything, which, you know, I love data and I love measuring everything, but we forgot the humanity, right? Yeah. And so we're trying to bring that back.
Is that why texting is a big part of what you, or maybe I'm guiding it
wrong,
so you'll tell me, but it's an important part, right?
Yeah, because it's free form. It's, you know, it is the conversational part. It's how we talk, right? And so I shouldn't have to speak in some structure, aka a form or something like that, for you to understand me, right? And so I should just speak naturally, like we're having a conversation right now.
And you tell me, maybe this was part of the aha part you were telling me about earlier, but I have had this thought and I've been thinking about this in prep for our conversation. We text our friends, we text our spouses, we text, right? The people closest to us, we text more than we email.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us, I think. Certainly I do.
And same.
So as I was thinking about getting ready to talk to you, I was thinking, yeah, it is weird we don't text companies.
No, but if you look at different generation, other generations and people coming online, they do. So if you look at what they're doing in Asia, whether it's with WeChat or in India, they do text companies. They don't know the difference, right? And those are billions of people coming online. If you look at my daughter, again, who's 13, she'll have a message with a company on Instagram. She, in her mind, that That's conversation, normal. Yeah, is the same as having one with you and me. There's no difference in our mind. But to a lot of us, we think that's weird or different or whatever, and we haven't adapted to that.
And I only have two companies in my life that text me on a regular basis, and both of them are in the drug industry.
Mm-hmm.
So my CVS texts me when my prescription's ready.
Yeah, yeah.
And my pot store texts me and says, yeah. Hey, we just got some new pot. Come on
Come
over.
Come on down.
Yeah.
And, both are smart.
And it's like, and it occurred to me because, you know, thinking about today, I was like, huh, no company does really text marketing to me other than the drug companies.
Yeah. Yeah. They're smart. That's why they're making so much money.
Those drug pushers,
pot companies.
They're crafty on the technology.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So the rest of us need to catch up because really for all of these, we're in the minority now and we don't know that we're in the minority of people that are not having these, not defaulting to messaging, but you look at younger generations and you look at generations who have had no other access until recently, and that's what they're doing.
Yeah. Now, I also have to ask you, as somebody who came up on the product side,
mm-hmm.
and now you're a CEO.
Yeah.
You know, so we've had conversations with guys who've come up on the sales side and become
yep.
CEOs, like we had mm-hmm. Jay Larson on pretty recently, and the legendary Doug Merritt from Splunk and
yep.
others. So I got to ask you the same questions, which is, you know, you grow up, you're a product guy, you're a technical
yep.
guy,
mm-hmm.
you're the CPO of one of the hot, you know, it's interesting to me how there was a moment in time where it looked like Marketo was going to be the company that mattered.
Yeah.
And like
100%.
They just started to do donuts in the fucking parking lot and well, you guys crushed them. Anyway, tell me about the transition from, you know, in your career, moving up the product ranks, becoming a product co-founder and now being a CEO and what's that like?
Yeah, I think the, you know, part of it is me, but part of it is the world has changed. So, you know, I've started 5 companies and along the way, you know, I came up from the software engineer side. Then I was a serial kind of CTO of companies that I had started and then chief product officer and then CEO. And so I think what's different is obviously there's an evolution that I've gone through, but the industry has evolved, right? I was telling a story to some of the youngsters here was that, you know, when I started my first company, I wasn't the CEO. Even though I started the company, I was the CTO. And we did what every company did at that time. And that company we started in the year 2000. That was to bring in someone with more experience, a business guy, you know, from the outside, you know the story, and bring them in as CEO. Because all venture-backed companies at that time, that's what they did, right? I call it like the pre-Zuckerberg era, right? There was no product guys. There was no people like that who were typically keep, you know, retaining the CEO slot for long. The conventional wisdom at that time was to bring someone from the outside. And I was whatever, 26, 27, whatever. And so I went along with that. But now, like now it's common for that product person, for that founder to remain the CEO in most of these companies. And so that's changed in the industry. And I think the other thing that's changed in the world is that the emphasis on the product side of things versus the business side of things, where before we thought, you know, the business side was the most important part, meaning the strategy and all the stuff that Michael Porter and Drucker and et cetera, they write about, which is super important. And the product was less important. And now it's really like, I think as an industry, we think that the product is the most important part. The thing that that whole customer experience is the most fundamental part. So that has changed. And for me, myself, like, you know, engineer to tech to product to now CEO, they're kind of like a progression of the same thing. As an engineer, the thing that I liked doing was, and I got off on, was building something, building my entire world. But that just happened to be some code that I had built, right? Some product that I had built. And then when I did it as a CTO, I did that with teams. And then when as the chief product officer, I did it with teams of technologists and product and design. And now as a CEO, I do that not only with those teams, but also with marketing and sales and, you know, business operations and all that kind of stuff. But I kind of fundamentally think it is the same thing as like, I'm trying to create our own world, right? My own world or our own category.
That's awesome. I'm also curious to find out, how do you round yourself out, so to speak? In other words, mm-hmm. you clearly trained yourself in marketing and category yeah. design. Mm-hmm. You've clearly trained yourself in selling. Mm-hmm. You feel like a natural salesperson. You'll tell me whether or not you are.
But, not. You
know, I've talked to a lot of product engineering oriented mm-hmm. founder CEOs, and they've shared with me the challenges around learning to sell or yep. not being snowed by the VP mm-hmm. sales on a bullshit forecast. You don't have that radar yeah. yet, or God knows marketing people can spew bullshit better than anyone yeah. else. And so mm-hmm. how have you sort of developed that side of your skill set to be a legendary CEO?
I lean on a lot of things that I didn't in the early days, which is like, I try to learn from others more than anything else, right? Like, you know, I don't want to make the same, I don't want to make all of my own mistakes. I make plenty of mistakes, but I don't want to make all of them on my own. So I want to try to learn from others. So I've relied on mentors and role models, and I talk a lot about that stuff on a podcast we have called Seeking Wisdom, and it's kind of core to what we
awesome
do.
Awesome podcast, by
the
way. Oh,
thank you. Thank you. Hey.
I don't know how big it is. My sense yeah. is it's a fairly big one, but the people who love your podcast love the shit out of your podcast. Like, they think
Thanks,
you are
dude.
The mayor.
Thank you. So we just share stuff that we're learning on that. We're obsessed with learning. And so like, I did it through mentors and what have you, role models, which is super important, which we can talk forever about. But then I also did it by reading, right? I did it by reading and by being, I'm naturally introverted. I'm naturally a quiet person. I'm the last person to go wanting to go out and speak in front of a lot of people, although I do that all the time now, right? But I just trained it, like as Arnold Schwarzenegger would say, it's all reps and sets, right? Reps and sets and reps and sets, and kind of taught myself this stuff. And not only taught myself, but learned to, from a place of empathy, like appreciate these skills that I didn't have and respect them, right? Not just like, oh, it's just some sales bullshit or whatever, but really try to understand like, how do people make decisions? Why do people buy the way that they do? What is the social psychology that's happening in our marketing, in our language, and all of that stuff? And I actually geek out and spend all my time reading about that kind of stuff, which I never would have thought I would have spent any time as an engineer. It's all the other side of the table where I spend my time geeking out on today.
So you threw yourself into that area
those
areas.
Deep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was hard, right? It was uncomfortable. It's not natural for me. But then I discovered something which on marketing and sales specifically was that it's all about social psychology. It's all about how do people make decisions. It's all about like, what are the biases that come in when we make a decision to buy something or that we like a certain product, and started to study that stuff, especially a lot of the stuff that Charlie Munger would talk about or write about. I'm obsessed with him, and he's Warren Buffett's partner, yeah. Berkshire Hathaway. And so a lot of stuff that he would talk about, and you know, he mentioned a book that I've read probably like 7-8 times called Influence, Robert Cialdini. And I think it's a fundamental book. I don't think you understand selling or marketing if you haven't read it. And it basically goes over the cognitive biases that we all have and how we make decisions. And it's fundamental. I mean, and from that, I think you can learn a lot.
That's cool. I haven't read it. So you just put it on my list.
You're going to love it. Yeah. Influence. Must read.
So I also have to ask you, you know, there's been a huge discussion in business and mm-hmm. the tech industry about diversity.
Yep.
Obviously, I'm a little whiter than you, although yeah. we do have the same barber.
Yeah, same barber. Yeah, same look. I love it.
How long have you been doing the old shaverama here?
Oh, man. A long time now. Yeah. 12 years.
Oh, wow. Okay, so yeah. that's good, but I got you beat on that one. My hair started going back. I noticed I was in trouble at 21 when it started to go. It's one thing when it sort of slides back at the top, but when the sides yeah. start going back, you're like, huh. I did Rogaine for like a month. And then yeah. I thought to myself, what are this. You doing? This is the yeah. opposite of who you are. You are not that
totally.
Guy. No disrespect to anybody who wants
no,
to.
No, no, no.
but that's not me. And then I thought, it's going to come out in 25 years from now that Rogaine causes dick cancer or something. So
yeah,
I just said, fuck it. And I just started going shorter and shorter and ultimately shaved it.
Just embrace it. Embrace it.
Yeah, but you, but I got to say, talk you me look about a lot sexier than me, though. With
it. You mine has a built-in tan.
Oh, yeah.
And you got
yeah,
a and I've had the tan. Beard forever.
Yeah, I read an article recently that the sexiest look, in terms of the most manly look that women like today, is the bald with the beard move.
What? Get out of here. Finally, I've come in vogue.
Yeah,
I've
no,
had
you're
this
the man.
For 15 years. 15 years. That's awesome. So yeah, let's talk about
we don't
about
have
diversity.
To touch on it specifically unless no. you want to, but I'm just curious.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, you don't see a lot of founders of color in our industry.
No. So, you know... So it's interesting. It's kind of surreal. So like, I try to keep it, interesting. I think, you know, one of the things that's been surreal for me is like, you know, I kind of was in this industry. So I'm Hispanic. My name is Cancel but it's just Cancel. So my dad's from Puerto Rico. My mom's from, Ecuador. And you know, and my co-founder is also Hispanic, which is odd, but until I met him, like a decade ago, I had never met another Hispanic, brown, non-Asian, you know, Indian person in tech. Like literally, I couldn't, and I'm from New York City. And, you know, it's not like I'm from a place that doesn't have diversity. And well, now I live in Boston.
Last time I checked, there's a couple of Puerto Ricans in New York, right?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of them. I was one of them. And, but I didn't know anyone in tech. I had never seen that. And so fast forward to now, and we have an incredibly diverse team. And one of the questions that we had at one of the company meetings here was someone asked me like, you know, basically they asked me like, they basically wanted me to tell them like, what am I thinking about diversity? And are we doing enough about diversity? And it was kind of a surreal moment. Cause I was like, wait a second. I'm like, I'm brown. I said that at the company meeting. And I was like, that's my New Yorker coming out. I'm brown. So I was kind of like surreal to be like questioned about like, am I thinking about diversity when all of I've dealt with my entire life is diversity. And I think, you know, the way that I summed it up was like, look, I don't think about diversity as like, and I don't like any like programs and, you know, staff, you know, like any of that kind of stuff, which companies do today and that's cool. But for me, it's like, I want to be real. I want to be authentic. What I want in our company is like for us to focus on equality. Like, right. I don't want anyone to be hired here because we have some program that says we need 6 more brown people. Right. Because that person on the other end, me being one of them, would not want to know that they got it. The reason that they got a job is because we needed 6 more brown people. Or 6 more women, or whatever the group is. It's like, let's be focused on equality and focus on treating people the way that we want to be treated. Let's focus on the skills. And if we do that, I think we can build an incredibly diverse team, which we have. But it's just a very different approach to diversity. I think it's one that comes from where I grew up in New York City, right? And we had, back then, we everything. You know, I grew up in the most diverse environment. I had friends who were hardcore people, punk rockers, hip hop, you know, metalheads, you know, Slayer, Metallica, you know, Anthrax, that whole thing. Like I had friends from every possible
group.
We're
talking rock and roll diversity.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
my
exactly.
kind of diversity.
And everything you could think of. And I've been to a million Slayer shows and all that kind of stuff. And so like, that's the kind of environment that I want to create. And I think we can create one that way. So it's how I think about diversity. And we've been lucky. We've created an incredible diverse group here.
And do you feel like there's any disadvantages that you have, or do you feel like has the pendulum swung and you have an advantage now? Cause you're a very sexy brown man or do you even think about it at all?
To tell you the truth, I'm kind of blind to it. And, you know, like I don't even see it because for so long, like, I don't know, I just felt like nothing was going to get in my way my entire life. And so like, I never thought about it. And maybe it's because I grew up in the environment that I did. But when I moved to Boston, which I did now like 18 years ago, my wife is, she's redhead with freckles of Irish descent, which is common here in Boston, but we met in New York City. And, you know, I was out at some outing with her and someone asked us, you know, something about how it felt like to be in an interracial couple or something like that, right? It was something like that. And the funny thing about it was like, I didn't know what they meant, right? And my wife said, elbow me and said, they're talking about us. And I was like, what? But I just tell you that dumb story because that's where I came from. Like, I'm just like, I don't even know what you're talking, what are we talking about? I had never even heard those words. Like, Boston was a different place than even 18 years ago than it is today. And the world is different.
Yeah. Very, very cool. Well, well, good for you, man. The other one I've been dying, the big question I've been dying to ask you actually is, for the better part of 30 years of my life, one of the machines that I've been raging against is
one of my favorites.
Is this unquestioned belief. I think it's true in a lot of business, but it is fucking true in our industry.
Yeah.
That it's all about the technology. It's all about the product. The best product wins.
It's nonsense.
We need the best engineers. We need the best product. And all we need to do, DC, is fucking put a demo on the website because if people can see our carbidingulator, they're going to get all fired up and buy from us, right?
You know how to incent me.
Yeah, and all we need in marketing is just give us some fucking leads and shut up. Yeah. And you know, the sales guys, they're just trained monkeys. As long as our technology is good and the monkeys know how to share the technology. And you know, there was this point, to your point, on Zuckerberg and Marissa Meyer and all this. There was this phrase you heard in the Valley a lot called, oh, we need a product CEO.
Totally.
Now, I want you to know, when I say these kinds of things, people assume, oh, marketing guy doesn't give a fuck about the products. Absolutely not. No. I consider myself a product guy. That was part of the organization I always loved being with. And I think today more than ever, you can't have a shit product. So you need the product. But if all you have is a legendary product and you don't have any category design, you're fucked.
Totally.
And yet I have recently been in Twitter fights with people about this. And so I'm dying to ask you, as a deep, deep engineer, deep product guy, who could very well be the stereotype best product guys, you're the opposite.
So I'm the opposite.
Tell me about that.
I think, you know, I've transitioned, you know, over time. I've kind of evolved. So I think it has to do with, you know, the world. What does the world look like now? And I think there were times and categories at a point where it was just about the product technology. But that was like two cycles ago. So like, if I just use my own career, when I started building software, you know, first generation, first wave, I call it, I say that was kind of like the very early days where it was just about like, could you actually even create the technology? And these are the early internet days. Like, could you even build it, right? And you could hide behind patents and you could hide behind proprietary designs and you could hide behind trade secrets and you could do all that kind of stuff. And in those days, you were usually one, two, maybe three people in a category, but usually, you know, single digits. And that would allow you to be able to win something with, you know, very, really focused on the technology. And then we went into the second wave, and I call that second wave kind of the first wave I call the Edison phase. And then the second wave is this, the Model T phase. And that's when I was at HubSpot and Performable and those companies, that's the era that we just came out of, which was like, it was about who can build a better factory, who has the better, you know, LTV to CAC, who has the better, you know, sales motion. Are we segmenting this thing? Are we niching this thing by, you know, vertical, horizontal, SMB, mid-market, enterprise, blah, 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 blah. And I'm just talking about the world that I come from. But we're past that now. And now I say, like, we're in the Procter & Gamble phase of the market in every market that I can think of and outside of medicine and government. And in all of those markets, like, there is an infinite supply of competitors. The world is flattened. You have competitors from around the world that can copy any technology, any product that you can build can be copied overnight. Whether it's a physical product, virtual product, it doesn't matter. It can be copied tomorrow, and you probably have hundreds of competitors in your categories. In some of our categories, we have thousands of competitors. In that world, it is no longer about just product. In that world, it is about exactly what you said, which is how do we own a category? How do we do that in the way that a a Procter & Gamble, Unilever, and some of these companies were able to do in those commoditized markets by owning a brand, owning a category, owning, making people feel a certain way. And yes, the product has to be great. Of course, that's one of the legs of the stool. But the go-to-market has to be great. The category has to be right. The timing has to, there's so many things that have to be right to come together. And I feel like in my world in software, that's where we are right now. But in, I see that in hardware. I see that in any given category. Everything has been flattened. And exactly what you talk about, which is category creation, is the most, and domination is the most important thing right now. I don't think you stand a chance without it.
DC?
Mm-hmm.
Is it wrong for one man to love another man?
Not in this case. Not in this case. Yeah, you, and your brother. Book was like, hallelujah, man. Hallelujah to me.
See, what I love about you and what you're doing is you are, you know, we call it the magic triangle. I don't care what you think mm-hmm. about it, but the reality is everything you just said is right. You got to get it all right. You got to get the product right. You got to have an incredible yep. product that delivers mm-hmm. massive value, solves a big problem. Of course. You got to get the company right, and you got to get the category right, and all the components in and around that. And the fact that you are not a product bigot,
no.
you are not praying at that altar of, hey, man, the best algorithm is going to slay the day, right? I think that's so incredible, and it's so wise, because you now have so many more weapons to win the battle with, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Exactly. So hopefully everyone else is still on that product kick, but that's over. I mean, that's
actually,
an important
funny you say
part
that,
of it.
When I get into these arguments with people and they say, oh, it's all bullshit and all, I'm like, hey, you know what? Good. You keep thinking that way. You fucking spin the propeller on your head and keep writing yeah. that code that no one gives a fuck about, asshole. That's,
yeah.
you know, I don't say that because I try to be a nice person, but that's mm-hmm. how I feel, you know?
Yeah. If you look at, I mean, we look at the stuff that, that Apple did in the products that they created, this holistic approach to the product and owning the entire thing, right? We look at all the other companies that we admire now, they are moving more and more towards this owning the entire experience. And the experience, I think, is the product. I don't think the product, the yeah. widget is the product. It's the entire experience, which includes the category, which includes how we talk about this thing and how we go to market and how it makes me feel.
Yeah, not just the experience of the product, but the experience of doing business with the company that provides
exactly.
the product, if there's a distribution channel or whatever.
Yeah.
It's the whole product in the biggest sense of the word, right? And the experience, that whole thing gets delivered.
100%. I think, and that's how I rant internally here at Drift is like, I'm obsessed with everything. I'm obsessed with like, how does it feel when we walk in this office if you were the first time to walk in? How does it feel like when you interact with someone from the company, whether it's official or non-official? How does it feel like when you use the product? How does it feel like all these things? Because I say the sum of those things is the product, right? All those things of how this made me feel, this is the product.
Yeah. Now, I also have been dying to ask you about this. As a guy who's a self-described introvert, and I'll make this other comment. I've said for a long time, I really believe the E in CEO stands for evangelist. And I don't give a shit
yep.
whether you're an introvert, an extrovert, or a fucking quadrupled, or I don't care what you are. You've
yeah,
got to
yeah.
be an evangelist. And you evangelize the category, you evangelize the problem, and of course you evangelize the company. And guys like Benioff and obviously Jobs and go back to Ford and whoever
totally.
You want, amazing
totally.
Evangelists, right? Sarah Blakely today, incredible.
Yes,
so,
incredible one.
You are an introvert,
mm-hmm.
and you've got this awesome, very popular podcast. You have a fairly high profile in the industry. You're out there. You've got this new book coming out. And so you are really living this evangelist, and you have been for a long time, even prior to being a CEO, best I can tell. And
mm-hmm.
so how have you become this evangelist that we see before us today, DC?
It's a good question, this transformation. And it's funny, I had never heard that, the chief evangelist officer, but I've been using something which is similar, chief explainer officer, right? But I'm going to take your version better. So I've always said, like, I'm the chief explainer.
You have a lifetime license. Go for it.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I had to make that shift. I had to make that transition to focus on explaining and teaching as being the most important thing that I focused on. And that's teaching outside the building, customers, market, everything that we do outside of that, partners, but also inside of the company, our team, and everyone that supports us. Because I, you know, my thought was to scale, to create this company, the most important thing for us was to explain this idea, to explain and to evangelize, to use your word, to evangelize what conversational marketing is and what we're trying to fight and why am I going to wake up and do this every day? And then part of it is selfish. Like for me to start another company and to get up every day and put on my socks and leave the house and not sit at home, I needed something that I really believed in, that fired me up, that would want me, that would have me tap dancing to work every day. And it's really evangelizing what we're trying to do and actually trying to fix a lot of the problems that we help create in this market and in the old ways that we did things that gets me up and charged up. And that's what's led me to go from introvert to being out there and pitching what I'm doing, because I believe in what we're, this transformation that's happening.
But so many CEOs don't do what you do. Like I tell CEOs all the time, why don't you have a fucking podcast? Why, what are you doing on LinkedIn? Nothing.
Yeah,
you know, nothing. What are you doing on Twitter? Fucking nothing. Like how many speeches did you give in the last 6 months? You're not at the fucking conferences, right?
No. Nope.
Or the other one that drives me crazy is, if you're a senior executive, CEO or not, and you can't give at least a B+ speech, fuck you.
Yeah, like, totally.
You
totally
need to go get trained to be in front of an audience and communicate powerfully and effectively in an engaging manner. And if you don't, that is, to use, you know, one of Jay Larson's great expressions, that's a condition of your employment if you're going to be a leader today. You
got to
get trained in that. Like you just, because anyway, so as somebody who maybe isn't quite as inclined to these things, you live a fairly public life.
Oh, yeah.
You're out in the world in lots of digital ways, and I imagine physical, real ways as well. And so how have you thought about sort of becoming this you know, evangelist, this out there guy that you are?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, part of it is the transformation I needed to do. But again, part of it is like where the world is going. And I was looking at the way that we want to communicate and the way that I felt like I could connect to companies and brands and leaders and what have you. And it was this deeply personal way. That was a big shift, right? 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, it's unimaginable. But just sharing what we've been learning, being honest and going back to that word authentic, like just being me, being real, you know, and putting that out there, and some people are going to hate it and some people are going to like it and maybe a couple people love it. Like, you know, that was the bet. And we made that bet early. I made that bet early. And I just wanted to be my real self, just like you're your real self. And I hear it and feel it on your podcast. Like, that's what people want. They're so sick of the bullshit, right? They're so sick of the pretend nonsense. And I was just like, I'm just going to put it out there. Just be me. And I think that's the way the world is going. And guess what? Even if you don't see other people doing it, if you look at where attention is going from all of us, like where we're spending our disproportionate amount of attention, it is to those people and to those stories and to that form of communication. And anything that seems contrived and nonsense, like we ignore that now, right? If it seems too made up, we ignore it. And so it's the way the world is going, whether you like it or not. And I'm a studier of the big trends that are happening in the world and the way that behavior is changing, because I think that is what we need to focus on in creating categories and creating companies, is not to try to create, invent something, but try to innovate and look at what's happening in the world and can I ride a wave, a momentum, a shift that's happening, that's already happened, right? Not try to create that from scratch.
Fascinating.
Awesome.
David, you're awesome. I could talk to you for hours, clearly. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on?
No, I'm good. I need to run off and do a company, company Zoom.
Awesome. Well, I will let you go. I'm a huge fan of just your sexy hairdo. I love what you guys are doing. I love the category, and I can't wait till you're a multi-billion-dollar category king.
Hopefully you'll have me back then.
Hey, I would love to have you back. It'd actually be very cool to check in with you. You tell me when the right sort of points are, but like with great founder CEOs like you and hot companies like this, it's fun to have you back on periodically so we kind of get underneath the, you know, the making of a category king, so to speak.
Sounds awesome, man. Thank you for having me. I'm such a big fan, admire your work, and you're a legend. Can't wait to talk again.
Well, stoked to have you back, and thank you so much, DC. Be legendary.
All right, take care, brother.
Okay, bye-bye. You too, brother. Whew. If you love DC as much as I do, why not share this episode with somebody you know right now? You can do that right from your smartphone or tablet or computer. And we would love you just a little bit extra if you shared this episode on social media. Now, is it grow time for your business? Our good friends at NetSuite want to help you master your growth. Go to netsuite.com/legends and you can set up a 1-hour free growth review with an expert in your industry. NetSuite is the business management software that handles every aspect of your business from an easy-to-use cloud platform. And NetSuite grows with you from the garage to the IPO and beyond. And today, NetSuite allows you to run your business from your smartphone. So if you're like me, you're out in the world most of the time, and you want to have access to everything that matters with some awesome dashboards to stay on top of your sales, finance, accounting, inventory, order management, and even HR. Thousands of the best-known brands and fastest-growing companies on the planet use NetSuite to manage their growth, and now it's available to you, backed by one of the largest technology companies on the planet, Oracle. NetSuite is offering our listeners a 60-minute growth review, an hour with an expert in your industry, because NetSuite has special capabilities for various vertical industries, and you can talk about barriers, opportunities to growth. So to turbocharge your growth, check out netsuite.com/legends. Hey, if you want to get a hold of us, we're going to start doing some more Q&A type shows. You can send your questions to blackhole@legendsandlosers.com. And we'd love it if you checked out our website and subscribe on our website so that you can always keep up to date with all of the hilarity going on here at Legends and Losers. And if you want to track me on Twitter, I'm @Lockhead. And if you want to get a hold of David, he is dcancel, C-A-N-C-E-L. On Twitter as well. All right. We would like to thank one of my favorite podcasts in the world, Seeking Wisdom, DC's podcast. Check it out wherever you get awesome podcasts. Our good friends at Spotify. You can now check out Legends and Losers on Spotify. Equity Directory, the invite-only network for entrepreneurs and startup talent. If you are in the startup ecosystem, you need to be on equitydirectory.com. The number one bestseller by Heather Clancy and myself, Niche Down, How to Become Legendary by Being Different. Pick up a couple hundred copies today. Check out nichedownbook.com or on amazon.com. The good people at onelifefullylived.org, the nonprofit helping you dream, plan, and live your best life. Check them out today, onelifefullylived.com. The official sock provider of Legends and Losers, John's Crazy Socks. If you want some awesome socks, go to johnscrazysocks.com. If you want to buy boring white socks, not so much. My friend Dushka Zapata's book, How to Be Ferociously Happy, and other essays. Dushka's writing will just make you feel better about life. Check her out. She's fantastic. Now, if you want to growth hack your business to whole new heights, check out secondflightconsultancy.com. And speaking of getting to whole new heights, if you want to lead your company forward, if you're at a specific inflection point and you want to drive positive change in your business, check out Flourishing Leadership Institute at lead2flourish.com. That's John Burgos Business with Scott Lowry. Check them out, lead2flourish.com. And we have a growing audience in Australia. So if you're in Australia and you want to do legendary marketing, check out rapidmedia.com.au. This is Von O'Connor's business. He's a dear friend of mine. He's been a guest on Legends and Losers. Check out rapidmedia.com.au. And the good people at Kiva.org, making a difference with microfinance loans around the world. Check out Kiva, K-I-V-A.org. Now, I must remind you that today's information is provided to you solely for informational purposes, and this oddcast is the sole property of the Legends and Losers Oddcast Network, and we love you even extra when you share the shit out of the show. All rights do remain disturbed. This podcast is clearly not recommended for wankers and is highly flammable. Be nice to your mother. Support your local entrepreneurs. Please tell two people you love about two podcasts you love. Don't be lame. Get out of the passing lane. Remember to listen to the Tragically Hip, only buy pasture-raised, free-range eggs. Thanks so much, Dandy Candy. I love you, Mom and Dad. And hey, Colin, this Oddcast really ties the room together, doesn't it? Today, our deepest apologies go out to Marcus Rust, CEO of Rose Acre Farms. Sorry, Marky, we just ran out of time for you. That's it, my friends. Thank you so much for investing your life with us. We really do appreciate it, and I look forward to seeing you again soon on Legends and Losers.